Welcome to the Seneca Podcast, a weekly discussion of current affairs in China, coming to you from the pop-up Chinese studios in Beijing. I'm your guest host, Mary Kay Magstad. For my day job, and often well into the night, I'm the China correspondent for the BBC Public Radio International program, The World. But today, the usual and inimitable host of this program, Kaiser Guo, has turned over the studio to women, a panel of accomplished women who I'm about to introduce, looking at women and power in the Middle Kingdom, in the home, in the workplace, in the property market, and yes, in this year of leadership transition, in politics. An old Chinese proverb says, women hold up half the sky, but all that's going to get you is sore muscles unless you're compensated for it fairly, given a voice and power, and treated with respect, with your rights equally protected under the law. So how are women doing on these counts in China today, and how does it compare with years past? I've got a great bunch of guests here who have thought long and deeply on these issues. First, Cao Haili, formerly of Caixin, China's hardest-hitting business magazine, now about to become managing editor of the soon-to-be-launched New York Times Chinese language website. Welcome.
Thank you.
And then welcome also to Didi Kirsten Tatlow, longtime resident of Beijing and before that of Hong Kong, who writes a column and reports for the International Herald Tribune and has written and spoken quite a bit recently about how the status and income of Chinese women is changing. Thanks for joining us, Didi.
Thanks, Mary Kay.
And finally, Leita Hong Fincher, a former journalist, is doing her PhD in sociology at Tsinghua University. The working title of her dissertation is Brides, Billionaires, and Buildings, The Gendering of Real Estate in Post-Socialist China. Welcome, Leita.
Thank you.
Leita, let's start with you. You make the argument that the real estate boom of recent years hasn't been as good to women as it has to men.
That's right. Well, ever since China privatized its housing, the price of real estate has really skyrocketed, especially since about 2004. And what I've discovered is there are three main ways in which gender inequality of wealth has been generated through the real estate boom. The first is that property tends to be registered solely in the man's name. The second way is that parents tend to buy homes for their sons and not for their daughters. And the third way is that women often transfer their assets over to a man, whether it be a boyfriend, a husband, or some other male relative, in order to finance the purchase of a home, which is then registered solely in the man's name.
And is there no option of registering it in both names? I mean, why does this happen?
There is. In the third social survey on the status of women that was just released a few months ago, the government said that about one-third of homes are owned or co-owned by women, and about two-thirds of homes are owned or co-owned by men. So you already have quite a drastic inequality there. But I argue that even those statistics really deliberately obscure the extent to which property is solely owned by men. What happens is it's a very deeply patriarchal society. The cost of homes is so expensive that it's almost impossible for one person to buy the home, to make the down payment on a home by himself. The norm is very deeply entrenched that the man needs to be the homeowner, in part because there's this belief that men need to own a home in order to attract a bride. So what tends to happen is that assets are pooled towards men. So relatives all pool their assets, and generally the money flows towards male home ownership. And there are many other factors, but that's kind of the underlying reason.
Right. And then there was a Supreme Court ruling just last year that in a divorce, the marital property belongs solely to the person under whom it's registered. So even if the wife has paid into the home, but it's registered in the husband's name, the husband walks away with the title.
That's essentially correct. There are people who will argue that the law, if a woman, for example, can document that she's actually put money into the down payment and she's contributed this much towards the mortgage, then if the couple divorces, then the woman would be entitled to that much money that she put in, plus the prorated appreciation of the home. But that's a very legalistic approach. First of all, there's basically no rule of law in China. Secondly, the social reality is that most women are not going to keep very detailed accounts of how much money they actually put into the home purchase. Another thing I found is that women tend to pay for the furnishing and renovation of the home, which is not going towards the appreciation of the fixed asset, whereas men often have automatic deductions from their salary going straight towards the mortgage payment. And then the couple will end up living on the woman's salary. And also, if the woman doesn't work, let's say she takes time out from the workforce to have a child, well, she's not putting money directly into the home.
Is this changing at all, though, with the one-child generation coming up, with parents putting their resources into their only child who's female, with that young adult having the wherewithal to buy an apartment? I mean, do you see that there's kind of a shift in power where women are perhaps disproportionately younger women are the ones who are the property owners?
Well, that's a little bit – there are several different factors there. First of all, there are a lot of scholars who've argued that the one-child policy has been a boon for urban women because they argue women don't have to compete with brothers for parental investment. And you see that's certainly true with education, that women are really getting a much better education than they used to. But unfortunately, what I found is that with the real estate market, when it comes to the vast sums of money that are involved in buying a home, the norm that the man has to be the homeowner is so deeply entrenched that I found even with a lot of only child families where it's an only daughter, there are parents who will decline to help their daughter buy a home and instead give their money to, let's say, their nephew because they consider the man to be part of the extended family. So unfortunately, I think that the real estate boom itself and the extremely high cost of homes has actually resulted in a reversal of many of the economic gains of urban women.
You actually said in an op-ed that you predict that women, and especially the sort of well-educated urban women of some means, might just start turning away from marriage as women have in Japan and Singapore rather than risk their wealth in a marriage. I'm wondering whether any of you are seeing any signs that that's happening, that women are thinking twice before getting into a marriage if it means that maybe they'll end up in a divorce giving away whatever wealth that they've contributed to the relationship.
I mean, that's theoretically possible. I wonder, though, if how real that is. Time will tell. You know, some of these new rules are quite recent. I think that, you know, the overriding desire to marry is extremely powerful among women here, as among women in most places in the world, of course. But, the social judgment of failing to produce an heir, for example, to have a child is very severe or can be very severe. So I think women are still driven very strongly towards marriage, and it may change a bit, but it's going to be a very it's going to be a kind of a change that happens perhaps in some places, but not in all places, for example. In the big cities among the educated elite, perhaps a little bit of that, but ultimately time will tell, but I'm rather dubious that it's going to actually be any kind of a quick change.
Yeah. Haile, what are you seeing with your friends and colleagues, both, you know, those who are, say, in their 30s and those who are younger, who came up as only children within their families?
Well, I think it's hard to generalize because depends on what generation you are. For example, my generation born in the 1970s, I have a lot of female friends who are still single. They're well-educated and they're very, financially very independent. It seems that it's very hard for them to find the right man. And it has become more and more common among Chinese well-educated women that it has become a social problem. I think the social structure is changing, but also, how Chinese women see Chinese men, for example.
How do you mean?
Well, traditionally, Chinese men, they're the master, they're the owner of the family, and women are sort of, women play a very subordinate role. But I think nowadays, women are more independent than before, especially if you have, good education, and if you have a good job, then obviously you don't really have to marry a man to be financially dependent. So that's one factor. But the other thing I think is China now is a society where people don't really care much about spirituality.
Mm.
So if a woman has a lot of, you know, sort of spiritual demand, and it's very hard for them to find the match mate who can tolerate that kind of women.
You mean someone who wants to practice a religion, or
not religion, not but that. Women who don't want to live just for material, you uh-huh. know, material success.
What would there be? What would be an example where there's a woman who wants to have something more, and the guy would push back and say, "Are you kidding? I don't want to be any part of that."
First of all, like a friend of mine, a female friend who is very sensitive. She likes to talk about, you know, even, you know, we are married, but we should talk about romance and love, that kind of thing. And then her husband will
go. Seems kind of reasonable.
Right. It's very reasonable. But her husband will go, you know, just, you know, mind your own business. Just like, I'm not really interested in that kind of thing. So you have this gap, which is becoming very common.
I find that very interesting observation. I've long noticed that among my friends that there's almost a very low expectation of what marriage can bring in terms of happiness. And I think that might be part of what you're saying, right? That and perhaps women are changing there, that women are saying, actually, I want more. You know, I want just more, better, richer. And, you know, if men are kind of, they're not there yet. They're not kind of, they don't get that yet. It's an interesting shift.
Yeah. It seems like the 70s generation is kind of the pivot generation, where there are still some of the older attitudes. I'm wondering whether the 80s generation and the upcoming 90s generation are already showing signs that maybe they're more open to a different kind of relationship with each other.
Well, if you watch TV, you know, watch like dating TV shows or some other coverage, you get this impression, oh, the young generation, like the 80s, 90s, they're very realistic. They just want to marry someone who has a house, who has, you know, who has a car, and who, you know, who has money.
Yeah, Valentine's Day keeps getting more popular every year, and certainly people talk about romance and wanting that to be part of their lives.
Well, I think it's more complicated. I mean,
of course,
you're going back to the whether parents will give money to their daughter to buy a house. I think it happens, you know, obviously happens as an investment. But the conventional wisdom is a daughter should not be worried about, you know, buying a house. It's the husband's job, and women, you know, make less money than men. That's so why women should take the responsibility or the burden to work herself so hard.
I wanted to actually add something. This is Leta. I actually interview a lot of the 80s and even some of the 90s. Generation in my research, because the actual average age of the home buyer in China is remarkably low. It's around the latest statistic was it's around 26 or 27, which is astoundingly low. And so I end up interviewing a lot of people in their mid-20s, which to me is extremely young. It's very young to be panicking about getting married. But unfortunately, with the vast majority of the women that I interview in their mid-20s, they literally are almost panicking about getting married. Mm-hmm. They're really worried about becoming a shengnü, a leftover woman. And it's just everywhere in society.
Were they panicking before the media drumbeat started on state-run media?
Maybe I shouldn't say panic, I think. Some of them are panicking. I make the argument that the Chinese government is actually deliberately pushing this term.
Because
I think that it's very complicated. I don't know for sure. This is not actually the subject of my research. But I think that the sex ratio imbalance clearly has resulted in a surplus of men. It's something like 118 men to 100 women now nationally. And there are women who are becoming much more accomplished. They're highly educated and ambitious. And any woman who is highly educated and ambitious would want to defer marriage. That's what happens around the world. So the Chinese government would only stand to reason. They would look at the surrounding countries, Japan, Singapore, Taiwan, Hong Kong, and where women are increasingly delaying and even rejecting marriage. Now, that actually has not yet happened in China. The average marriage age is increasing here, but it's still this intense pressure. And I would like to qualify what I earlier said, argued in an essay, that I actually am more pessimistic now because I don't see many signs that women are deliberately avoiding marriage. I think that's wishful thinking on my part, actually.
Yeah. So, you know, women are getting married. They're sharing their homes with their husbands who own the property title. In the home, I mean, in many cases, in and outside homes, power is often linked to money, who has it, how it's used. What are you finding in terms of, you know, how the power relationship goes in marriages these days? Are you seeing shifts in terms of how decisions are made, how much wives are willing to tolerate infidelity, mistresses, even domestic violence? Didi?
I mean, it's very complex always in China because it's an enormous country with vast geographical, economic, even cultural differences, and it's impossible to generalize about what's happening here. You have to at this point say, in this part of the country, among this type of person, how educated are they? But I think that there is definitely a stirring, I think, among very young women. By that I mean people who are probably born after the 90s, as they call it here, 90后, after 90, that I think there is a sense that they want more and they want better. But these women are still extremely young, and they've frankly got a lot of learning to do, and that's going to be a long and slow and difficult process, because what I see is really still that there is enormous cultural pressure on women to toe the line, to permit the man to make the decisions in the home. You know, what father says goes, 父亲说算, right? What husband says goes. You know, a woman may challenge it, may discuss it, but at the end of the day, he's probably going to make the decision. And, you know, I don't see a huge amount of loosening in that area. I mean, I think that the cultural norms that are at work here are simply so powerful that women have internalized them very, very well and are very much part of the situation. I mean, one example, women agree with men, and this is a rising trend in Chinese society now, that government statistics show that to the extent, you know, asked to say, do they or do they not agree with the sentiment that women belong in the private sphere, men belong in the public sphere, both men and women today in China increasingly agree with that statement. I think it's now at around 62% of men agree and 55% of women. And that has gone up by, if I remember correctly, over 7% and over 4% since 10 years ago. Huh. And these are enormous quantitative surveys that the All China Women's Federation has done of this country, of attitudes. And it shows very clearly that both men and women increasingly agree with that statement. So I actually think I would agree with later. I'm relatively pessimistic about the medium-term chances of change, but I think that long-term change is inevitable.
Didi, you wrote about how you feel that there's a rights rollback since the days when Mao Zedong said, whatever male comrades can do, female comrades can do too. It sounds, from what we're hearing now, like some of it is sort of voluntary. Some of it is a lifestyle choice. But you also were talking about wages and income and how that's being affected. Could you talk a bit about
that? Yeah, I mean, voluntary, what does voluntary mean? I mean, when you're talking about the return of very powerful cultural traditions here, which is essentially, I think, what started to happen after some time in the late 70s or during the 80s, then what is voluntary and what is culturally sort of produced? I think that's a very, very important point. These traditions never went away during the early Mao years, through the first three decades of the People's Republic of China. They were suppressed quite strongly in some ways, but I think they were always there. And women were, you know, put into the workforce in order to increase production for the communist state. And but they were left with the same burdens at home. And, of course, medical care improved too. So suddenly women were, you know, birthing 11 children, and 11 children were living, which had not been the case before. So they were out there working in agriculture, working in factories, and caring for a lot of children at home as well, sometimes with the help from their extended families, but sometimes without it. If you were a daughter, and you had a brother, you might be well out of luck and your parents would choose to help your brother raise his children and not you. And I personally know Chinese women who had breakdowns, nervous, mental, physical breakdowns over that kind of situation. So, you know, voluntary is an interesting concept. I mean, how far do we internalize society's values and reproduce them? I think that's a question that affects women all over the world, in the West as well as in China. And what is what we really want? You know, is it what we really want, or is it what we think we need to do? It's a very, very complicated issue.
Yeah.
Oh, I might add that in addition to the extremely intense cultural pressure on women, there is also systemic gender discrimination in the workforce. So these women are less likely to be hired than men. The government statistics show that women are – certainly that there are more women who get a college education than 10 years ago. But employers still hire men over women. They prefer men over women. And then they're often stipulated in the contract, even though it's in theory illegal, that a woman is not allowed to get pregnant. And if a woman gets pregnant, then she'll be fired. And once the woman is fired, she can't sue for wrongful termination. Or in theory, the law allows her to do so. But in practice, we all know what happens. She's completely out of luck. So in addition to the enormous cultural pressure on women, there's the systemic obstacles to equal opportunity.
I mean, it's interesting on the issue of education as well, because, yes, women are doing fairly well in education here, at primary level, at secondary level. Even at college level, it's nearly parity with men at the undergraduate level. Now, when you get to postgraduate, things start shifting. And by the PhD level, there's a massive drop. There are far more men than women doing PhDs. And the reason for that is very simple. There's sort of a joke in Chinese that there are three types of people, men, women, and women with PhDs. So any woman in her right mind who wants to marry, who wants to perhaps find in her right mind, I say it advisedly in parentheses, in quotation marks, will consider perhaps carefully whether or not she's making herself an attractive option by getting out there and getting a really good further degree. And that's something that they do think about very carefully, I think.
Yeah. So we're talking about, you know, some entrenched attitudes that haven't changed so much since the days of Mao. Haile, do you think that there have been lasting changes because of the emphasis the Communist Party put on giving women a fairer shake?
Well, first of all, I want to comment on Didi's. I kind of disagree with your conclusion about why women don't want to do PhD just because they thought that would make them unattractive?
No, that's obviously a simplification. I mean, I think it's another complicated phenomenon. But I don't think that women are necessarily thinking like that in a conscious sense. But I think that it's very clear that they're discouraged in many ways, direct and indirect, from becoming too scary, basically, from becoming too educated, too smart. You know, because a PhD inevitably leads to, or tends to lead to, better jobs, to higher incomes.
Not,
and what man is then going to be able to, a man may not be able to catch up, or to, you may simply may not find a good partner. That's, I think, quite a common phenomenon here. It's quite widely known.
Well, in terms of finding a job, for women, if you have a PhD, actually it's hard for you to find a job than an undergraduate. That's actually very common now.
It's harder to find a job as a PhD, than as an undergraduate.
Right, right.
Than with an undergraduate degree.
Right.
Right, but that's a labor market issue, not a gender issue.
Well, I could see where there could be a confluence of a couple of things we're talking about here going on. It takes time to get a PhD. You know, it's going to push you over that threshold of age 27 or age 30 whenever you become a leftover woman, right? So you'd either need to have an enlightened partner who's like, I don't care if you're 35 or 34, I think you're great, I want to marry you, or you have a much reduced chance of getting married and having that domestic life as well as your professional life, right?
And then for women, when they graduate from PhD, they're already like approaching 30, and it's time for basically family life. And then employers, of course, they will have a lot of second thoughts. You know, how hard you can work, and then if you get pregnant, and you know, there would be a lot of trouble for us. So they're not really attractive on labor market.
Can I just say here, I think a very, very important point is that you said that the phrase women hold up half the sky, which is indeed very famous, is a traditional phrase. It's not. It was actually crafted by Mao. Mm. He came out with it. And it's, you know, it started with the communists, if you like, as far as I know. And one thing that I find fascinating about it, and it has to do with the issue of consciousness among women. Now, China has never had that second wave of feminism that happened in the West, that happened in the US, that happened in Europe in the late 60s and the early 70s, where women actually said, you know what, this isn't good enough. I'm fed up with this. I don't want, you know, I want to be able to work. And when I work, I want to be paid similarly, if not the same as a man. That simply never happened here. And the reason it didn't happen was because in the late 60s and the 70s, and in fact since then, China has been politically a very, very tightly controlled society. There are no true independent social movements. They're simply not permitted. And what you would need here is, after the so-called first wave of feminism, which happened sort of pretty much everywhere in the world, including in China before the Communist Revolution, very interestingly, where very interesting and powerful Chinese women here in the 20s and the 30s, even before that, the end of the Qing Dynasty, they were very, very interesting, aware Chinese women. That second wave never happened. And I think that what you've got here is a situation where consciousness is simply in the cellar. It's very, very, very low. And that affects women of all ages, whether they're 20 or 70. And, you know, there just isn't the opportunity to get out there and push for change, because you can't push for change really publicly in a kind of an aggressive, overt, demanding fashion on anything in China.
How different is it in Hong Kong? You grew up there. Did they have the second wave there of pushing for...
To be honest, it's not great in Hong Kong either, but there are, I think, very specific reasons for that in Hong Kong. And they have to do with the absolutely focused economic attitudes of people there. Don't forget that the vast majority of Hong Kong people fled China. They ran often for their lives at certain points in Chinese recent history, ended up in Hong Kong as refugees. And at that point, it was just, you know what, just knuckle down, make money, and just make sure that your family survives. And I think that that atmosphere is quite powerful in mainland China today as well now. That economic imperative is sapping a lot of energy from the causes that people, I think, would like to pursue. So, yes, but there are, of course, there are feminists in Hong Kong. But I think perhaps a better parallel, because it's more of a country, if you like, is Taiwan. And certainly the women's movement in Taiwan is fairly sophisticated. I mean, they had a female presidential candidate recently. They've got a lot of very interesting women. And, you know, they're not kind of, it's not as sort of advanced, if you like, as in certain countries, particularly Western Europe, for example. But it's certainly happening.
Yeah.
Oh, could I just add that
I
would like to say I'm obviously the Communist Party has done an awful lot wrong, but I would like to. I really think that the emancipation of women, at least in rhetorically, but not just rhetorically, economically, that this was actually a good thing. That was one of the great gains made in the Communist Revolution. And it wasn't just rhetoric. There were quotas imposed. There was nearly 100% employment at a certain time of urban women, or maybe 90%. At any rate, the labor force participation for women was extraordinarily high. And so one of the legacies of that, and that was a communist initiative, is that China, even though I totally agree with Didi that there's been a rollback in women's rights in general recently, and the labor force participation rate of women has fallen, but it's still not drastically low yet. So we're looking at a relative decrease in gains. And so that's one of the enduring legacies, but that's rapidly eroding.
Hailey, what do you think? I mean, if you compare your own situation with your mother's and possibly your grandmother's in the 50s, 60s, 70s, do you feel you have more choice about how you want to live your life, that you have more rights within society, that the courts will back you up? How would you compare where you're at compared to where they were?
Definitely, the society is changing and people have more choices. But again, it's like for me, the pressure is not from the society, but from my parents.
Didi, you had mentioned, Mao said women hold up half the sky. Isn't that enough? I mean, obviously, when you look at the political realm, They haven't really walked the walk as much as talking the talk. There's one woman, I believe, in the Politburo, Liu Yandong, who's also being considered possibly for the Politburo Standing Committee. National People's Congress has 20% women. Let me come back to you, Haile. I mean, do you see this on the road to getting any better in terms of giving women more of a voice in politics? Are you seeing any signs that this might start to shift?
Well, frankly, I don't see that way. I think in politics, politics is not good for women, especially in China. It's really you really need to be very strong and then sometimes play dirty games. So for average women, I wouldn't suggest to go into politics in China. But in areas like media, you see a lot of women taking the helm, like Tai Xing or any other, like Hong Huang. So in those areas, like you have a fair amount of competition, but also it requires some skills women can do fairly well. So really depends, which area. But in terms of politics, I don't think you can really compare China's situation to, say, Western Europe's, even the U.S.
Yeah, and in the U.S. as well, in Congress, it's only about 17% women. But you were about to say something, Didi.
Yeah, and I just wanted to say, I mean, the Irish example is interesting, for example, because they've also had a very kind of slow development there, and that's been largely because of the dominance of the Catholic Church. Very, very male, obviously, institution. Women can't be priests, so I think that is self-explanatory. They have just now, you mentioned Western Europe, and it's a very uneven situation everywhere in the world. The United States has relatively few congresswomen, less than in China, even in terms of parliamentarians. However, I would suggest that they have a lot more power than their Chinese sort of sisters.
Well, in China, it's
in
a quota-based system. Like it they is said it like 20%, so they would just look for...
The Soviet Union used to have that too, and after the end of the Soviet Union, of course, it collapsed. And actually, what's interesting now, however, is that it's creeping back up. Women are entering the Russian parliament, in greater and greater numbers and with more power. Now, because this relates to the overall political situation here, which is it's a whole very interesting topic of its own, how women fit into that. But the Irish example, just to finish, is simply that they've realized Ireland had an economic implosion in 2009. It was a total disaster. And there's a strong feeling there that this was not, it cannot be attributed to, but part of the reason it happened was simply because of this very clubby boys' network of people who are all the same or all men. They're all sort of from a similar social backgrounds. It's also a class issue, getting together, nudging, winking, and just making deals amongst each other. And women were shut out of that very, very, to a very large extent. And in fact, they are now bringing in for the first time quotas to elect, to impel political parties to put forward a certain amount of female candidates in the next general election. This is the first time that they've ever had quotas in Ireland. It's slow catching up in terms of Western Europe with some countries, particularly in Scandinavia, but it is happening. So, it's a very uneven situation, I think, in many countries in the world.
Right. Well, I would add that old boys' network is certainly true of Chinese politics. The Baijiu culture, in order to do a business deal or advance politically, you have to consume vast quantities of Baijiu. You often have to be publicly seen with your mistress or maybe multiple mistresses. Mm. And certainly it's extremely difficult. First of all, it's double standard. How could a woman possibly stand out? Maybe she could drink equal quantities of Baijiu, but she can't show up with these suitors
or her toy boy.
Just because of the double standard. So that's certainly one barrier to women advancing in politics.
Yeah, but then you have some great example like Wu Yi.
She's very much the exception, if I may say.
She's the exception, but how did she do it? I mean, did she blaze a trail anyone can follow in younger generations?
She's so much the exception. I mean, I think Wu Yi just tells you about Wu Yi. She was a very unusual person. Can I also just say, however, even Wu Yi, who is or was tremendously powerful, did not make it onto the standing committee of the Politburo.
Yeah, she was
vice
premier.
A very important point.
Right.
Even she didn't make it on.
Yeah. So, Leda, what do you think? I mean, do you see any shifts in
politically
younger generations that suggest, well, for instance, Didi, you wrote about a 47-year-old woman who I think ran for a local government seat,
got trounced,
but she gave it a try.
She wasn't even permitted to run. That was the point. She's now 47. I think she was 46 when she tried. Liu Ping is a remarkable woman who lives in the southern province of Jiangxi, and she's a very interesting story because she encapsulates many of the key issues, I think, affecting women here, particularly in politics, but also socially. She was let go from her job in a state-run steel factory at the age of 45. It was younger than that. It was perhaps 43. That was the whole point, because in China, by law, men work longer than women. Women are retired earlier. There's a mandatory retirement age for women, which is at least 5 years before men.
Mm.
And the rationale behind what that was that somebody had to look after the aging parents at home, so get the woman out of the workforce and help her, you know, enable her to be that person.
And in the 90s, it was as young as 35 sometimes. Right,
exactly. Now, she got caught up in that whole thing. And as a worker, she should have retired, I believe, at 50 as a woman. However, her state-run factory was firing people. Women have always been in the front line of those firings in the 90s during restructuring. We know that. And she was one of them. She was fired, and I can't recall exactly, was it 43, somewhere around there. The men that she had risen with, she worked in the factory all her life, kept working until 50. Now, she compared what she got as a pension. When she was first fired, she had something like 475, I believe it was around 400-something renminbi pension. Her equivalent men, her colleagues, were still earning, you know, 1,500, something around 1,500, a bit more than 1,500. Now, that's a huge income difference. She was earning a third. And they did that for 5 more years. So their pension at the end of that was higher. And that's always the case, as far as I understand how these things work. So she decided as a result of this injustice, because she was absolutely struggling. She's also divorced, which is a tough position for a woman to be in China financially. And she has a daughter whom she's trying to put through university and is indeed putting her through university. She decided that she was going to try and agitate for change, and she ran to be a member of her local parliament in Xinyu City in Jiangxi province. Now, she took a megaphone and walked to the local bridge and started to just tell people why she thought she should be a member of this parliament. She was shut down very, very quickly. The police would come along, the uniformed and ununiformed security people. She was taken away, and the problem went on and on and on. She wasn't in the end even allowed to put herself forward as a candidate for parliament, her local parliament, even though under Chinese law she is allowed to do that. You can be nominated by ordinary people in your locality. You don't have to be chosen by the party or by mass organizations such as the Workers' Union or the Women's Union. You can be nominated by local ordinary citizens. However, in practice, that is increasingly being ignored. I think that the government is extremely worried about more and more people being elected to local parliaments and just agitating for change like she wanted to. So she didn't make it in, but she's still out there and trying to push for change in other ways.
So, yeah, it's interesting because, I mean, women perhaps are more, in all likelihood, are more conscious of inequalities in terms of rights. So just by running, they're already challenging the status quo and the party. And so
absolutely. I mean, I think women are a far more vulnerable sector of the population. They have access to fewer social goods. I mean, in terms of income, we know that, you know, women's income relative to men's is dropping in China. That's been the case for 20 years now. And there are statistics from the All China Women's Federation that prove that very clearly. Highly sensitized. An interesting point, though, I'd like to add is that when I said to her, do women in China have rights? She didn't even initially answer the question. She said, and then she sort of thought for a bit and she said, well, no, women in China have no rights. And the conversation continued. And then she said, but you have to understand, nobody has any rights.
Right.
And I think that's really, really sums up a really important point, which is the nexus of rights, of women's rights with other rights, which are also struggling here to assert themselves.
Yeah. It's interesting that she made the connection and recognized that politics is a dirty game, but, you know, if you want to make a change, you need to get in and start playing it yourself and not let it just be a boys'
game. Yeah, she's extremely clear about that. Her slogan is she wants to change China one vote at a time.
Yeah. An interesting challenge to the party in this year of leadership transition. Anyway, let's move on to recommendations. Leyte, what do you have?
Well, we didn't talk about domestic violence, actually, but so before I move,
I was saving that for.
Okay, so my recommendation is actually it's a Chinese public service announcement to try to get people to speak up if they hear or see domestic violence, and this was produced by the Half the Sky group in collaboration with UN Women. And there are these actually two 15-second videos that are quite powerful. And they're running on the internet, but unfortunately, and yet another sign of lack of rights for women, that domestic violence is simply not seen as a problem worthy of addressing by the government. And so these PSAs are not running on television. But they're worth seeing.
Not seen as a problem worthy of addressing because they figure this is just a domestic issue. It's a private affair.
Well, again, I can't say exactly why this is. Partly it's due to the lack of political representation among women, simply that the men do not see gender inequality as a serious problem. They also don't see domestic violence as a serious problem. I personally suspect that one of the reasons why the government is not tackling domestic violence and has not introduced any specific legislation to control domestic violence is that they see the government sees it as a social stability problem because domestic violence is so rampant that if you were actually to put restrictions on men, for example, not allowing the man to enter the home if he's abused his wife, then there would just be too much anger for the government to deal with.
I completely agree with what Leyte just said, and I think that social stability here right now is also feeding into sort of traditional concepts of sort of almost Confucian concepts. Huh. And the Confucian system, of course, is all about the state controls the people or is superior to the husband is superior to the wife, the father is superior to the child. And, you know, the only relationship where there is any equality is between friends. And I think this is sort of part of that whole idealized sort of Confucian state, you know, society, which is based on rigid hierarchy.
Yeah, kind of ironic that the government is pushing an idea of Confucianism in modern China, since it was very much opposed to Confucianism for quite a bit of the Communist Party's tenure in power.
Yeah, well, it's a very syncretic state at this point, I think. One could perhaps, some people call it a situation of market Leninism, but you could also say it's a situation of Confucian market Leninism or market Confucian Leninism. It's
confused Leninism.
Confused Leninism. It's certainly an odd creature.
Okay, as long as you have the mic, what's your recommendation?
Okay, it's a novel by a young woman writer called Sheng Keyi, who is a wonderful person, and she wrote this novel called Bei Mei, which means Northern Girls. It's been translated into English, and it's just out this year, actually, published by Penguin. And it's about a young girl, I say girl advisedly, she's 16 when the novel opens, who leaves her home village in Hunan to head to the big city to make money. And I think that this actually, it's one of the bright spots for women in China is that they are leaving the farm. They're getting out from under the thumb of very heavy cultural expectations. Cultural prejudices is a better phrase. And making money in the cities. And they're often going back and saying, well, okay, you know, but you better treat me better because I've got money in my back pocket, you know.
Money and power yet again.
Money and power. And, you know, it's a real bright spot, I think. And interestingly, it's also apparently leading to a fall in female suicide
in rural
China.
Areas, which used to be one of the highest rates
absolutely
for women in the world.
Absolutely used to be. I think it was the highest rate for women in the world. And China also had the strange distinction of having more women kill themselves than men, if I remember correctly, which is also very unusual. Women's suicide is dropping. And part of the reason, I think, is because they're getting away from the farm. Because in the farm, there's a lot of difficult stuff going on, and there's always rat poison in the corner, and a lot of impulse suicides.
Although, interestingly, when you choose rat poison, it gives people time to save you. So it's also sort of making a statement of, my life is too terrible for me to go on like this.
True. But will it work? Will you be saved? Will they even bother to save you is another question, too. That, but to return to my recommendation, so she wrote this novel about a young woman who goes off and really seizes her own destiny and makes money in the city and encounters enormous problems. I mean, encounters so many attempts to sexualize her, to turn her into a prostitute, essentially, which she could make good money at. It's a feature of this novel, that, which is sort of a funny thing, that this woman, young woman, is blessed with rather large breasts. So she's a sort of a sexual object from the get-go, if you like. And, you know, that's a huge issue here as well. Like, large boobs on a woman is a real attraction. I mean, for men, it is everywhere in the world, you could say. But it's almost considered a sort of a fault on the part of the woman as well. Why are you so overtly sexual, you know? And she has this, and it's sort of her burden. And she, you know, that all sorts of things happen there. There's the issue of abortion. There's one woman in the book is forcibly sterilized by mistake. It's the wrong woman gets seized by the authorities and forcibly sterilized. This is a woman who hasn't had children yet. And when I interviewed Zhang Keyi at a book event last year, when the novel was still only in Chinese, she said that she personally knows women this has happened to. It's not common, but it happens.
Haile, do you have a recommendation?
Well, if I may, I want to recommend two books.
Sure.
One is written by my former Caixin colleague, Xu Xiao, but it's a republish of her book, first published in 2005. She's from the old generation, sort of after 1949 generation, and then she was one of the founding members of Beidao's a poetry publication called Jingtian. So she belonged to that sort of small circle. And this this book is basically a memoir of her own life and then the people she worked with, like Beidao and Yu Luoke, and those people who played a very important role in the 1970s and 1980s. And the book is very beautifully written, very, very moving. And the other one is related to the, you know, the countryside life, Liang Hong's Liang Zhuang, which was also published early this year. Liang Hong is a literature critique professor at Beijing Normal University. And her hometown is in Henan, a small village in Henan. She left her hometown at 20. And since then, you know, when she left the hometown, she became a city person. But, you know, after so many years, she felt like, you know, as a professor, you know, every day she's talking about those, you know, literature, you know, stuff, which is not very connected to real life. So at some point, she felt like, you know, I have to go back to my hometown to see how people live there and what the problems there. Because right now, with the urbanization, ultimately the problem lie how we deal with the countryside, how we deal with, you know, peasants, and how we deal with the, you know, the damage of a village, and also as well as the lifestyle. So she went back and then spent 5 months living there, and documented the 5 months she spent there, and she talked to people there, and she still has family, you know, she has family in hometown. And I think the book is really a good work that captures, through a small village, captures what's going on in China in the large picture. So I would really recommend that book. Yeah. Great.
And my recommendation is a book that actually came out a couple of years ago, but I'm just reading it now and enjoying it. And it's called Somebody Else's Century, East and West in a Post-Western World. It's by Patrick Smith, who in fact was an editor at the International Herald Tribune, where Didi now works. And it looks at it through three essays that sort of intertwine, looking at the experiences of China, India, and Japan. It looks at how each of them has absorbed some aspects of modernity, of modern technology, and of modern life, while revisiting their own traditional identities and culture and figuring out what parts are important to them in the interface, what they want to hang on to, and what they want to adopt from outside. And in several cases, it's sort of a struggle that they're still working their way through. And with that, we'll end this edition of the Seneca podcast. Thank you to all of you, to Didi, Haile, and Leita for a fascinating and very rich discussion. And next week, the usual host, Kaiser Guo, will be back. Please tune in.